Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:10 p.m. in the Pacific Summer Time. Today is November 8th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off with the Dow Gold ratio because there's been a lot of speculation in the market about what the direction of gold is likely to be and whether we have seen the peak, whether there has been this move on the upside was entirely because of demand for a safe haven because people were worried about a global recession, or whether there is simply more to it than that. I think just to answer that question very simply, I think there's more to it than that. When we then think about what's the outlook for stock markets, well, we know that the S&P 500 has had 3 18- to 19-month ranges over the course of the last decade. Each of those has been resolved on the upside. Then it has been followed by a very prolific and persistent period of trending. Then you get, generally speaking, during the trending phases, the 200-day moving average has been a touchstone in terms of where people have looked to buy the dip. During those ranging phases, then we're presented with significant periods where you can get an almost or a potentially a 20% pullback towards the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And in a secular bull market, those reactions towards the 1,000-day moving average in fact represent some of the most attractive buying opportunities anyone is likely to see within the context of a secular bull market. The Dow Gold Ratio just plots the Dow divided by gold. It's one against the other. There are a number of consistency characteristics that jump out to me when we look at this long-term ratio. We have data that goes back to approximately 1920. The first is the pattern of outperformance by stocks. We have higher highs. That means that every successive equity bull market has done better relative to gold. Now, there is another way of thinking about that, and it is that each successive bull market has been driven both by fundamental causes but also by access to liquidity. And the purchasing power of currency has inflated, The purchasing power of currencies has deflated because of inflation in terms of the quantity of money that's being produced. And therefore, it makes logical sense that asset prices would appreciate relative to gold in the bubbly phases. And they should do, the asset inflation should, in fact, become even greater as we go on in terms of the historic and systemic depreciation in the purchasing power of fiat currencies. So that makes sense. Then, of course, we have the fact that you've got technological innovation, which has been an incredible force in terms of human development, particularly over the last 100 years, considering the point that quantum mechanics was only theorized 100 years ago, and now we have it increasingly coming into commercial utility. It's not even theoretical or confined to laboratory or university use any longer. We are in fact starting to see the very first services coming through. Well, that kind of pace of innovation is really quite startling when we look at the double helix of DNA from the time when it was first discovered to the commercial reality of sequencing the first genome. Synthesizing the first genome, in other words, writing the code from scratch to come up with a human genome. That's the Human Genome Project 2.0 is still underway. They've achieved it for modest success stories like yeast and for the fruit fly. But of course, what everyone wants to see is what does it take to produce a fully functional genome for a human. But again, the amount of time taken between theoretical, just coming up with the idea of what it looks like, to commercial reality, it has been really quite short in terms of the the way that we think about the evolution of society over millennia. Well, we're at a period now, there, if we just simply go back to the consistency characteristics of this trend, well, we have certainly seen that when we look at the way that these bull markets have evolved over time, then the big moves have tended to end in acceleration, but they also tend to have these periods where you can have a good deal of ranging. And that was certainly the case in the 1950s, where we had periods where gold did rather well relative to equities, even within the context of a bull market which was substantially larger than the preceding bull market in equities. For example, between 1959 and approximately 1962, equities went nowhere relative to gold, and that was still only a range within the eventual climax. There was a significant bear market in gold during the late 1990s, and that was greeted on the other side of the equation by a massive bubbly environment in the technology sector. So then we had a phenomenal move on the upside in terms of this trend. Well, the other point is that there's not a lot of consistency between the low and the peak in terms of duration, how long it takes to get from the low to the peak. But when we start to think about how long it takes to get from peak to peak, well, it's about the same. It's about 35 years. That 35 years is, I think, an important number. And it tends to gel with the Kondratiev wave. So that's also sort of out there on the back burner. When we then think about the consistency of this trend, well, we've certainly seen a significant rally for gold relative to stocks over the course of most of this year, really. Now the bigger question is whether this has been the limit of the performance of gold versus the Dow, or whether we're going to move into a more rangy environment. I suspect it's more of the rangy environment, that there are going to be periods of time when equities do better, and I think that on balance equities will do better than gold. But the bigger point is that we are approaching a period today where there is not only a war on cash, there's a war on taxpayers. We are, I think, we're also at a position in period where there is a clear potential that we're going to have modern monetary theory become very clear parlance in terms of the communication and cooperation between the government and the central bank. I think it is increasingly likely that that is going to occur in an increasingly large number of countries. In fact, we might already argue that it is already well in place. At one point, the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates, reducing the size of its balance sheet, in direct response to the incredible tax cuts that were pushed through immediately after the Trump administration took power. So they were trying to balance out the stimulative effect that that would have. Well, that's now over. The US government is running $1 trillion deficits, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet is increasing, and they are cutting interest rates. They've cut interest rates three times. There has been the temptation to think that this has been a mid-cycle slowdown, and that there is the potential that we're going to get a re-acceleration in growth, and I think that there is a good chance of that. But it is being fueled by liquidity, and the fact that the Federal Reserve is now moving in lockstep with the government, that there is a certain amount of cooperation is already underway. Well, what that really suggests is that modern monetary theory is already in evidence. It's already also in evidence in Japan, where they have been running both easy monetary and fiscal policy for years now. Now, they're about to raise the sales tax in Japan to try and pay for all of this monetary stimulus, and that has certainly helped to beef up sales ahead of the tax rise. It will probably translate into lower growth a quarter from now because of the front-loading effect. We've had exactly the same kind of phenomenon in the USA, where there was a massive front-loading of and an inventory build at the end of last year that translated into lower growth in the first three quarters of this year. We're running through that now. There's the prospect that the trade war is going to come towards an end. So that does have the, at least a partial end, I think would probably be the more correct way of saying it. There is additionally the US presidential cycle. And the first year of the cycle tends to be the worst because they tend to prime the pump in the latter half of the third year, going through into the fourth year, in order to give a boost to the incumbent and to try and win the election. They promise as many spending initiatives as they can think of, and they do in fact start to follow through on that ahead of the election to lend credibility to those promises and to put extra money in people's pockets so that they'll vote for the incumbent. This is not new. This has been something that's been going on in US politics for at least 100 years through both Democrat and Republican administrations. The US presidential cycle worked in 2016 and it worked in 2012. It did not work in 2008. Generally speaking, the fourth year of the presidential cycle generally tends to be among the best. Well, 2008 was among the worst, so that is the exception that proves the rule. What I think is more important is that when we look at what's going on right now, well, we are seeing evidence that the pump is being primed, that they are increasing spending, that interest rates have come down, that the Federal Reserve generally does start to cut interest rates ahead of the election in order to help and to assist the incumbent to try and get re-elected. Anyone who thinks that we haven't had this kind of cooperation in the past is kidding themselves. Therefore, we already have the foundations for modern monetary theory. It's more that it has been sotto voce, that no one has been willing to talk about it in clear terms, that it hasn't been official policy, but it has been policy. Well, that's where the change is, that it could quite easily become official policy. One would have to ask, if that's really the case, are we going to see something that's really very different? Other than the fact that there is more of a willingness to support massive deficit spending. And deficit spending does not last indefinitely. Eventually, we will see an environment where the ability to continue to run deficits will get tapped out. At that point, there will be a recession, and the minimum that we can expect from that will be that the market will pull back to test the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, let's look at that longer-term chart of the S&P 500. And when we look at that, well, I'll put up the 1,000-day moving average that is six. Well, in fact, that's it already. It's 60 months, which is 5 years. And what we're presented with on the monthly chart has been evidence of support being found in the region of the trend mean on successive occasions. It's important to look at the candle chart rather than the line chart because of the intraday moves, or at least intra-month moves. The more important point is that this is not the first time it's been a useful indicator. And we've had successive occasions when the 1,000-day moving average has been an area of support. But that stopped back in 1994 and early 95 when the market really did take off on the upside. Even today, the moving average is approximately 600 points below where the price of the index is trading. That's at least a 20% pullback. And there is the potential that we're at the point in the cycle where the market does move into a bubbly phase. The one thing that I'm rather conscious of is the application of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle as applied to the stock market. And rather than talking about particles, it is more about the greater the knowledge there is in the market of the consistency of the trend, well, the greater the likelihood, therefore, is that people will try and anticipate that move, and by anticipating, they change the market. That another way of thinking about that is that big bull markets change the fundamentals. And we are seeing that in these markets as well. The number of IPOs has picked up, and private equity firms have been accruing vast sums in anticipation of getting a buying opportunity. We've also seen a misdirection of capital into private equity in the, I think, a direct response to the fact that we've had such incredibly low interest rates that people have been incredibly yield hungry, so they've been buying into private equity. Well, when we then think about the consistency of the trend, then the time when we do tend to get crashes, when we get these very large pullbacks, is either at the end of the cycle or in the middle of a long ranging phase. That was certainly the case in 2008, and it was equally the case in 2000 and in the year 2000 or 1999. When we look at this market right now, it is breaking on the upside. It has completed the most recent of these ranges. It's found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And as long as it is continuing to extend this push on the upside, well, I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. If we think about the consistency of the move, well, on each of the occasions when it's broken up out of these ranges, it has rallied for an additional year and a half, which would take us all the way through to the November 2020 election at a minimum. The first year of the US presidential cycle is generally the worst, and that could equally be the case that a year from now we could be looking into the first year of the new presidential cycle beginning in January of 2021, and that would represent a rather big challenge depending on what the outlook is for the liquidity that's flowing into the market, who takes over as takes over in the White House, and what kind of policies does that person implement. So those are rather significant, I think, issues. Now, when I think we look at the much longer term chart of the S&P, well, we can also think about some of the kind of seasonality that we get in terms of the market. Because generally these ranges last for anything up to about 13 or 14 years. And generally speaking, once we've had the breakout, then we can get moves that last for upwards of 20 years. Well, that has certainly been the case over history. The length of the ranges has been rather consistent. The big question now is, how long will this big bull market continue? It is, well, the one another way of thinking about it is that major bull markets thrive on liquidity. And the provision of massive sources of liquidity from central banks and governments with synchronized monetary and fiscal stimulus greatly enhances the potential that we are going to move into a bubbly phase. And that could be quite similar to the kind of environment we had back in 1987. It wasn't so long after the big break higher, and that was in 1979, so it was about 8 years. Well, our breakout right now has been in 2013, so we're only about 6 years in. There is the scope that with the pricing in of technological innovation and the kind of growth potential that that represents, where we get artificial intelligence coming out of university departments and into the real world, where the rollout of 5G, which is an incredible enabling technology, and is likely to be enabling in exactly the same way that 4G was, when that greatly enhanced the ability of companies like Facebook and Google and all of the social media companies to deploy artificial intelligence and to sift through the massive quantities of data that people were willing to just give away for free in order to satisfy a narcissistic urge. Well, that is incredible value creation for those companies. And it's about to take another notch higher, because we are approaching a period where the number of connected devices is going to multiply. The rollout of 5G will make the Internet of Things a commercial reality. There will be sensors deployed everywhere. There will be incredibly quick Internet access, which will allow cloud computing and cloud-based technology solutions to be available at our fingertips everywhere. That will further enhance the ability of artificial intelligence engines to provide real-time assistance. And it is essentially what companies like Amazon and Google and Apple are attempting to create, is an artificial intelligence butler. When you have a butler, then you would be sharing a great deal of the intimate details of your personal life with that person, and in return, they can tailor a solution that makes your life feel a lot less congested, and that they are providing a great deal of services that you really wouldn't like to spend the time doing yourself. I've often thought of the way that technological innovation tends to evolve is to think about the kind of life that someone in the upstairs portion of Downton Abbey, or a Georgian, or I guess a Victorian gentleman, enjoyed, and think about how that can be delivered to a person without any of the physical infrastructure that's required. Because it is the dematerialization of services that represents the peak of technological evolution. When we used to have record stores, and we used to have bookstores, travel agents, we now have Google, we now have YouTube, we now have Kindle. Well, where we used to have people that were providing services, we're increasingly going to have artificial intelligence. This is equally applicable to mundane tasks around the house, whether it is setting reminders to pick up the kids early from school because there has been a teacher's in-house day, whether it is to book a restaurant or to keep an eye out for a cut price theater ticket, and then to book a restaurant on the same day that the tickets are available, whether it is to then to think about the other kinds of solutions that could be provided in terms of managing one's day, in terms of making sure that the daily chores that people have to run around to fulfill become easier to do. There is also, of course, the two big professional areas that have been free from disruption for a significant period are law and medicine. There is a significant portion of the law sector which is pretty much involved in form filling, and that is already being disrupted by companies like LegalZoom. Well, it is only a matter of time before Google, for example, can do the same thing to the two lawyers that it has just done to companies like Expedia. Expedia built a pretty impressive business by acting as an intermediary between between consumers and hotels and airlines. Well, Google decided that they could probably do it better, and when you go to Google and type in anything it is so simple to demonstrate rather than just simply talk about it. Go to Google and say LAX to LHR for London Heathrow, and it simply pulls up every single one of the flights, and then if I want to buy any one of those, it takes me directly to where I can start paying. Well, that is the kind of service that Expedia used to do, and they used to pay Google in order to get that first place on the search engine when somebody typed in LAX to LHR. Now Google is taking that revenue for themselves. It also means that they don't need to take the revenue from the advertising that Expedia once would have been spending. They have supplanted the intermediary. There has been a further disintermediation. It is the advertising company has taken over from the client. This is exactly the same thing that Amazon used to do. I think probably still does. The greatest challenge for a seller on Amazon would be to be too successful. That would move the needle in terms of the revenue that Amazon was accruing from that seller. They would look at that person's products and see if they could supply them at a cheaper price, and then they would start doing it, and then the third party seller's business would evaporate. That has led to Amazon providing Amazon Basics, which supplies everything from underwear to colored pencils. And that's something that is, they have been able to sift the data and come up with additional business lines to supplant, and I think, or perhaps a better way of thinking about it is to add additional revenue streams to what their classic way of making money had been. These companies are not only intermediaries, they're not only supplying search, or they're not only supplying a marketplace. They are gathering the data from these marketplaces, deploying their artificial intelligence and their networks to try and figure out how people are making money in those networks, and then to take that business model and redeploy it with the efficiency that they're able to garner from the strength of the network they control. Well, obviously, there is an antitrust element to all of that. That is something that is going to necessitate that we have a conversation about privacy, about the ability of companies to control every facet of our lives. Personally, I'm not active on social media. I certainly don't own a smart speaker. I regard them as literally taking a spy into your house. But that doesn't mean that they haven't sold millions of units, and that there are billions of people on social media who are more than happy to share even the most intimate details of their personal lives with all and sundry, and in the full knowledge that that data, once exposed, will be in the public arena in perpetuity. These are But this is where we're going. There's a strong likelihood that we're going to get the not the robot butler, but the artificial intelligence butler is, I think, pretty much ready for deployment. The fact that we have 5G in the wings, that the number of handsets that are anticipated to be sold this year will be upwards of 100 times greater next year. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing the semiconductors index breaking higher. And it has been leading on the upside. This has been a phenomenal move over the course of the last few weeks. Now, there's no doubting that it is overbought in the short term, and the wider market as well is susceptible to some pause and consolidation. But the reality is that when a market has been going sideways for a year and a half already, then there is clear potential that we're going to get some pause and consolidation. But probably not more than that. That after the market has been going sideways, you get the breakout, and the surprises tend to be on the upside, even with the risk of some consolidation. And I think that's why it's important to pay attention to what's going on in gold. Because if the bull market that is evolving on stocks is, I think, on the cusp of bubblehood, well, then people will need to have some form of hedge against the potential for the devaluation of fiat currencies to become a real phenomenon. Now, certainly the move that we've had in gold this week, where the price has pulled back in a dynamic manner, that enhances the potential that we are going to get a swifter process of mean reversion. But the underlying base formation is 6 years long. Gold tends to be volatile, and the best time to buy is following reactions. Upward breaks are seldom sustained. In terms of the bull market, it and generally playing gold, it is generally better to wait for the periods when it does pull back, because it doesn't generally provide really attractive, consistent trends. It tends to provide choppy trends. Even when we think about the phenomenal bull market that went all the way up from lows during the period in the early 2000s, well, there were some significant periods of underperformance, even as prices continued to hold the upward bias. I suspect that that is now what we are going to see. We're going to see a period where gold is volatile, and it is likely to have some rather lengthy periods of consolidation, but that overall prices will continue to rise. There is the additional point that I think is relevant to simply be aware of. It's the synchronicity that we have with the kind of move that's going on right now. Because we had a very significant pop on the upside in 1999. Subsequent to that, prices pulled back sharply and ranged for approximately 2.5 years and then broke out. Well, after the breakout, this was I think, a rather significant move. So if we take the point of from the breakout up to that peak, it was approximately 17%. It pulled all the way back down to test the upper side of the range. It even dipped below the trend mean, and then it moved into a further bull market where prices went up very significantly over the course of the next decade. Now, if we go back and think about what happened in 2016 and 2015, we had an equally impressive move on the upside. And subsequent to that, prices went sideways for about 2.5 years. And then they broke out. And the size of the breakout is approximately the same. It's about 15%. Well, the last time it was 17%. On this occasion, it was about 15%. Now, the last time, the price came all the way back down and tested the upper side of the base formation. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that it could do exactly the same thing on this occasion. This is, I think, one thing that we've learned from trading in gold over the course of the last 20 years, that it is prone to volatility. And it is the kind of asset that will test an investor's resolve. But when we think about what it is that is going on out there in the world, that we have synchronized monetary and fiscal stimulus, the very clear intention to not only devalue the currency in people's pockets, but to also eliminate the currency in people's pockets, that there is a clear war on cash that is most acutely evident in places like China, where using cash is becoming progressively more difficult. And really that one does have to have an online payment app like WeChat Pay or Alipay in order to buy just about anything. What that suggests is that the devaluation of fiat currencies is not only going to occur, but it will be competitive in nature. Right now, the dollar index remains rather steady, and it was up in additional positive territory in here today. It has clearly confirmed support in the region of the trend mean again in just this week. Now, this is rather different to what we've seen previously, because the animating factor behind the move that we've had in the dollar index over the last few years has been the reduction in the Fed's balance sheet and the fact they were raising interest rates. Well, they've been cutting interest rates, although they've probably stopped, and they are now increasing the size of the balance sheet. The fact that the dollar continues to rise, well, that is more a reflection of the weakness of other currencies. Europe needs a weaker currency. Their growth figures are deteriorating, and they are badly in need of additional stimulus. So the euro is still trending downwards. Then when we think about the Japanese yen, Japan wants a weaker currency, and the fact that the yen has been appreciating, that has certainly been depreciating, that has certainly been of benefit to the Nikkei. Well, the Nikkei now is somewhat overbought in the short term. It's coming back up towards a previous area of resistance around the 24,000 level. So there is the potential that we're going to see some pause and consolidation. One thing that I've been watching out for in terms of an indicator that we are in the latter stages of this bull market has been the absence, or at least the potential, for commodities to come back and join the party. The continuous commodity index has been pretty much ranging for the last 3 and a bit years, and it has now just broken its sequence of lower rally highs. Now, it's been a bit volatile over the last couple of days, but if it can continue to hold that region of 400 and improve upon it, well, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The London Metals Index has been ranging for most of this year, but it is now on the cusp of pushing back up and out of this 6-month base that's been forming. There has been a rather lengthy period of consolidation going on since August, I guess more like June of last year. Now the big question is whether it can push back above the trend mean. When we look at some of the agricultural commodities that have been particularly beaten down, well, coffee in particular, it looks like it is starting to recover, and it is It has previously found support around the dollar area, and that does appear to be offering support right now. I'm rather interested that we have this commonality with Robusta coffee, and that is now right in the region of its trend mean. Cocoa prices have also been steadying in here and are pushing back up towards their recent highs. Cotton prices have been trending down for the last few years and are back testing the region of the trend mean. If a trade deal is done, then agricultural products are certainly going to be a part of it. Soybeans is at the upper side of the range that's persisted over the last year, but it is a fraction of its peak value back in 2012. I think when we look at what's going on in the world, then what we are seeing is increasing polarization. And that is particularly evident in the US presidential election, where the fact that President Trump himself was a polarizing character, that greatly enhanced the potential that the person who would run against him in the next election would also be a polarizing character from the other side of the political spectrum. When we look at what's going on in terms of the UK's election, then there is no doubt that Jeremy Corbyn is a polarizing candidate, and the fact that the Conservative Prime Minister right now himself is also Boris Johnson is a very polarizing candidate in terms of his personal life and the strategies which he has deployed, which has been to alienate a substantial portion of his own party. That is also representative of this polarizing effect. You have Emmanuel Macron in France trying to position himself as the leader of the liberal elite and the liberal world order. But the reality is that that is to ignore the on the ground, I think, reduction in living standards that so many people have experienced. I thought there was one rather important point that, and I know that historically I have been banging on about the importance of manufacturing jobs in economies. But there is, I think, an important differentiator. It's not that manufacturing is necessarily the most important thing on its own. The more important point is that manufacturing jobs tend to pay well. Mining jobs pay well. And you don't have to be particularly well educated to do them. You might have to accept not particularly attractive working conditions. You might have to accept that there is some danger in what you do, but the compensation for pursuing those kinds of jobs generally tends to make it worth it. One of the fastest growing areas of employment in the USA is, in fact, in the services sector. But when we think about services, it's not services like when people are working at Google or working at Amazon. It's more like in health and leisure. Now, the problem with half of new jobs coming through from the health and leisure sector is that there is, and I will put some numbers on that. There was 46.6% of the 131 jobs that came through last month was in leisure and hospitality. Now, these are not good paying jobs. In fact, they're the worst paying jobs in the country, and that's a very significant factor. So when we think about that, there is the real potential that we've had a lot of growth coming through in terms of the number of jobs, that the USA has got the lowest employment, the lowest unemployment in history. But the problem is that the kinds of jobs that have replaced the millions of jobs that have been lost in manufacturing have really been paying a lot less. That is not just true in the USA. It is true in the UK, and it is also true in the majority of Europe. So when we then think about why is it that we have this massive polarization in terms of the political classes, it's as a direct response to that. People are still working the same number of hours. In fact, people might be working more hours, but their compensation for that work is considerably less, and the number of calls on the resources that people have only increased. 40 years ago, well, even 20 years ago, I remember vividly having the discussion with myself about whether I really needed a mobile phone. I was working as a door-to-door salesman when I was backpacking in Australia. I had to get a phone because I needed to do customer service for the people that I signed up in order to ensure they didn't cancel before I got paid. That was the turning point for me. I had to have a phone. But of course, that phone has morphed since then, but the bill hasn't morphed. The bill you get for your mobile phone is an additional utility, and it is these additional utility costs that are increasing in terms of the call on people's monthly salaries. The fact that Microsoft, which is now the biggest company in the world, has in fact adopted itself so that it is now more of a utility type play than it is a cyclical technology play. And that is a direct response to the fact that the purchasing power of the individual has been decreasing, that people are not quite able to put the money together to make the $300, $500 or $1,000 purchase, but that they can pay the $13 or the $14 every month. That is the essence of the subscription business model. That is why Netflix has been able to perform, but it is also why Apple has priced its offering at $5. It's why Disney has priced their offering at even lower than Netflix. Well, what this is also suggesting is that the subscription business model is incredibly compelling, and it works particularly well for a very well-moated asset. Something where the company has got an invaluable service they provide. That's perhaps not quite true as true for Netflix as it is for Microsoft. One of the best examples of this renewable source of income is in the cybersecurity sector. Once people, in fact, buy their antivirus, then they will not do without it, and they'll pay for it every year. But what it is essentially doing is creating a utility type of cash flow. Now, we can look back at Disney, and we can see that there have been periods when the share has done very well, and then there have been periods when it hasn't. There is a cyclicality to its business model. One of the reasons why it did so well between 2010 and 2016 is because it went on a buying spree and accrued all of this intellectual property. It has focused over the last few years on making movies and trying to leverage that intellectual property. What it is now trying to do is to turn it into a cash flow and to have people avail of their library on an ongoing basis for $5 or $6 or $7 a month. they are attempting to adopt the subscription business model, and this is potentially transformative for the company, or they'll fail because they are in an environment which is highly competitive, not exactly like Microsoft, but it is certainly sustaining the breakout and bouncing from the region of the trend mean. When we think about what it is that people really want, it's that they want more money. When you think about what it is that is driving this move in the in populism, it's because people are asking, what about me? This isn't something that's simply going to go away. It is going to require a meaningful change. Whether that is going to be lower taxes or higher wages or a mix of both or greater social services is largely going to be dictated by who wins the elections. The one thing that is, I think, most important from a market perspective is that taxpayers don't become the enemy. In an environment where everybody pays their taxes and is a consumer, then that generally is benign for markets. Where taxpayers and the wealthy become the enemy, and they become the piggy banks for the government's visionary or vanity projects, that generally translates into lower stock prices. If we have to think about what the risk is, then it is this populist backlash is, I think, the most profound challenge that we have out there. But in the meantime, we have had markets breaking on the upside. I think the most likely scenario is that we are entering the bubble phase and that we are going to get a really quite impressive bull market. That the most, I think one of the more important points is that following a yield curve inversion, the market has generally tended to rally. That after the inversion in the first inversion in 1998, the market went up 50%. After the first inversion in 2005, it went up 30%. Well, after the first inversion on this occasion, the market has rallied. It hasn't stopped yet. But on historical precedent, it could rally anything from 30 to 50%. And that's before we get trouble coming through in terms of liquidity. That's why I think it is important to pay attention to the TED spread. There has been a great effort underway to try and brush the repo problem that caused a massive spike in repo rates under the carpet. The response by the Federal Reserve has been to massively increase the size of its balance sheet. Putting on $250 billion in the space of about 6 weeks is a really quite profound response to that kind of scenario. What it also suggests is there is virtually an unlimited call on the Fed's resources. Now, the most important thing to pay attention to is that the TED spread is still really very well contained. That it really wasn't until it started breaking through on the upside and really above the 50 basis point level for a sustained period that we had to worry about a real problem in the banking sector. But it is trending higher. So that is something that we have to pay attention to, that the liquidity conditions that are that have been revealed in the repo market have to be monitored. Even while we look at the wider market and the potential for, I think, rather significant potential upside, that the most important thing to remember is that the bubble phase can be among the most prolific on the upside, but that acceleration represents a trend ending. Now, what we've seen right now is a breakout, and acceleration out of a range is what we expect. Ranges are explosions waiting to happen. But at some stage, the market will accelerate, and that will provide a really excellent opportunity to take some profits off the table. Or perhaps a better way of thinking about it is to raise some cash ahead of really attractive buying opportunities. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.